Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern, von wo aus auch immer Sie uns zuschauen. Ich melde mich zurück und begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, aufgezeichnet am Montag, dem 11. November 2024, nach einer ereignisreichen Woche, einem Erdrutschsieg, darf man sagen, von Donald Trump in den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika, sozusagen eine seismische Verschiebung der politischen Landschaft. Und gleichzeitig hatte ich in Sotschi die Gelegenheit, sozusagen von der anderen Seite des Ozeans, da die russischen, chinesischen, indischen, brasilianischen, südamerikanischen und auch norwegischen Perspektiven aufzugreifen. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass wir die Gelegenheit haben, einen von mir hochgeschätzten Politikwissenschaftler, Professor Glenn Deason von der University of Southeastern Norway, hier noch einmal in der Sendung zu begrüßen. Ich hatte die Gelegenheit, schon in den kaukasischen Bergen mit ihm zu sprechen. Jetzt ist er wieder hier. Er ist hervorgetreten als Publizist, natürlich immer wieder auf Substack mit substanziellen Artikeln zur Geopolitik, und er hat ein hervorragendes Buch geschrieben über den Ukraine-Krieg, das mir auch sehr wertvolle Informationen gegeben hat. Und was ich an Professor Deason sehr schätze persönlich, er ist ein mutiger Intellektueller, er ist ein mutiger Politikwissenschaftler, er kennt Russland sehr gut. Er hat hervorragende Beziehungen in die Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika, etwa zur University of Chicago, zu Professor John Mearsheimer oder zum früheren Botschafter der Vereinigten Staaten in Moskau, zu Jack Matlock und vielen anderen hochrangigen Persönlichkeiten. Also er steht hier sozusagen an der Schnittstelle zwischen West und Ost und ist eine Stimme, eine unbequeme Stimme der Vernunft, die eben auch Gegensteuer gibt. Und aus dem akademischen Bereich heraus, ich wundere mich immer wieder, wie er es schafft zu überleben, aus dem in dieser zum Teil etwas vernagelten Atmosphäre, und da immer wieder auch Gegensteuer geben kann. Ich switche jetzt auf Englisch, damit er uns verstehen kann. Er ist schon in der Leitung. Und I want to send my best regards to Glenn, Professor Glenn Deason in Norway. Hello again. We met in Sochi, and it's great to have you here in the program in our Institute of Advanced Studies of Contemporary Affairs, of the Studies of Reality. This is our core business, and great to have you here. Was it good, your trip back from Sochi to Norway? Everything went fine?
Yeah, very good. Very long, by the way. We have the flight closing down the mutual flight space, of course. One has to travel very long distances through Turkey, which is strange. Usually, if you fly from Oslo to St. Petersburg, it's a 2-hour flight, but now I have to go through Istanbul. So it's
Okay.
all the distances seem to change.
So, but at least you could land in this fantastic airport, which reminds one of a huge shopping mall where you have a lot of things you can buy, and it's a nice stopover. I had to fly via Dubai, which was even a longer trip probably.
Oh, it's a
Okay.
beautiful airport too.
Okay, great to have you here. We have both been at this conference, at the Valdai conference in Sochi, and there was the crowning event, you could say. Of course, everybody expected it. It was highly interesting. We saw the Foreign Minister Lavrov on Wednesday, and then Thursday there was this performance of Vladimir Putin over 4 hours. He was communicating with our group, with the audience of about 100 people. Russian media were there. You were one of the presenters. You presented the results of your study group, geopolitics, and you asked him also a question. What was your impression of this evening with Vladimir Putin? What's the most important observation?
Well, firstly, the Valdai format is an interesting one because, yes, you've been there. All people meet for 4 days from morning to night to discuss with different experts. And the first 2 days, there's You have all these panels. On the third day, there's usually some of the top officials from Moscow coming by. And of course, on the fourth day, there's this plenary session with President Putin. Well, I guess for there's a lot of things covered, but the overall theme of the discussion this year was the construction of Eurasia. So they're referring then to the development of new economic connections. So everything from not just diversifying trade, but also developing partnerships for technology, developing their new banks and payment systems, trading in their own currencies, and of course, there's physical connectivity with ports and roads and railroads, digital cable. So again, it's a very huge area. In addition, they're talking about how with this new distribution of power, there's also going to have to be different rules. So largely dismissing a lot of the universalism which the US has legitimized its hegemony under. So a lot of focus on the restoration of conservative principles, just a basic idea that each country or each civilization should be able to pursue its own path to modernity, that you don't have one center of power which can dictate to others. So I think for me this is the key area which I found very interesting.
That was one of the key points in the speech of President Putin in his 50-minute speech, which was read from the paper, very disciplined, very fast rhythm. He was pounding forward, one could say. And he said in his presentation, yeah, all monopolies have to die. And now the monopoly of the United States of America, the monopoly of power, is seeing its end. But before we go into the substantial intellectual message, I would be curious how you just witnessed the performance of the president. It was the first time for me to see him in such over such a long distance. And I mean, I'm a longtime journalist since many years, almost 30 years. I've been in politics in Switzerland. I've been in Germany in journalism. I've talked to a lot of powerful people, and I could observe them. And everybody's different and fascinating in its own way. But this, something like this, I haven't seen before. I mean, 4 hours, you asked also a question. The questions didn't have to be prepared, or that you didn't have to send them in. It was really improvised, and he talked. He seemed to me very open-minded, even sometimes, relaxed. He seemed very confident. What was your impression if you would look just about at the appearance he had and the whole setup of the thing, and how what kind of impression did you have of President Putin personally?
Well, I remember in your comments to him, you pointed out that this was quite impressive to speak like this for 4 hours. And it is impressive because, especially when you've had leaders in one place for a long time, the key concern then is, of course, that one would result in stagnation. But it's quite interesting because he's held the presidency now for 24 years. It's almost a quarter of a century. And he speaks for 4 hours. Again, he has his own script, the first speech, which he goes through, which is about 40 minutes. And the rest of it, he just does interaction. And even, his the chair, the one interviewing him, is, of course, Fyodor Lukyanov. And he kind of directs who should get a question. But suddenly, in the middle of it, Putin takes over and just say, "Oh, yeah, I want to select people who to ask." So just pointing some random at people, around the room, who would like to take questions from. So, yeah, certainly a lot of this is very spontaneous, but I guess objectively, some people like him, some people don't, but this kind of energy and engagement with the public, I would like to see this from more politicians around the world, because I think in the West, one of the things that that annoys a lot of people is we have too much focus on speech acts, and almost all speeches are written by marketing people now. It's like, well, what's allowed to say, what's not allowed to say, what's controversial. So they talk, use a lot of words, but say almost nothing. So to have a leader just confidently outline his position, take questions from everyone. It is impressive skill to have, and I think it's yes, a lot of energy. One can say the same about Trump, but often with Trump, I think maybe again he does very long speeches, but often there's more repetition and more empty words, perhaps. But again, he's also very impressive with all the energy. But I think yeah.
And if you point out Trump, of course, is the master of exaggeration. I mean, he
Yeah.
somehow gets away with this almost absurd extravagances of speech, where you think from a, we could say middle of the road perspective, oh my goodness, I mean, he's overdoing it. And I had the impression Putin is the opposite. He's like, he seemed very differentiated. Also in his language, was very disciplined. He almost apologized before he said something negative about someone. And yes, he was he tried to be as accurate as possible. And my reflection was, when I listened to that for this long period, he was never yawning. I mean, he was always there. He was fully present, even though it was in the evening already. It began rather late. And my perception was, whatever you think about what he says, whether you think, I mean, he has totally miscalculated this war in Ukraine and he made a huge mistake and has weakened Russia, if you're totally against him, I think he's a substantial man. And the way he's criticized, especially in the West, especially by our media, by some of our academics, by some of our politicians, it seemed to me so out of touch, so out of, it's a totally not adequate standard to counter also this politician, which means that probably in the West, he's not really taken seriously. I mean, they somehow seem to underestimate and say, well, this is Putin, the propagandist, the dictator, the terrible guy, Ivan, Vladimir the Terrible, which is a certain kind of arrogance. Our people are not dealing with him seriously. That was a thought came to my mind. And what do you think about it? Is that did you have similar thoughts, or was there another point you would like to make in this sense?
Well, there's many disadvantages of being in power for this long, but one of the advantages is there's a long track record. And if you look back at the statements coming all the way from Bill Clinton to George Bush, I think even Barack Obama once was said that, Putin is, he, well, I'm not sure if to use the word trusted, but he's a man you can deal with. And again, he's measured. And I think, again, I know we're not allowed to say anything positive about a Russian president in the West anymore, but there is something about this diplomatic demeanor as well. Because even there was, sorry, there was one question about this, trans women, which are biological men competing in male sports, and he kind of mocked it as this being absurd. And then this one representing from Algeria was, contesting whether or not, he was saying, "Oh, you're probably referring to this Algerian boxer." And he took the time to say, "Listen, if this is an actual woman, I apologize." So he still, as a respectful way of talking to people. For me, this is becoming a bit unusual almost, because if you listen to our politicians these days, when they speak about other leaders, be it Erdogan or Putin or Xi or like whoever we don't like these days or we told we should hate, you always have this very aggressive effort, and the goal is always to delegitimize them. So this is also why we don't meet with leaders we don't agree with, because we don't want to legitimize someone we don't agree with. But
This is, I would say, this is one of the great diseases, intellectual diseases on our side, demoralizing. I mean, if you try to understand someone, for example, you try to make sense of his decisions, whether they are right or not, this always is considered to be kind of a legitimation. You're trying to justify the other guy. If you try to understand what are the historical reasons of the conflict in Ukraine, and you see that the West has made some mistakes, suddenly the people come, ah, oh, you want to justify the enemy, you want to justify. We're somehow in a Cold War mentality of mind. And this is, by the way, why I think it's so refreshing that you take the liberty to differentiate. And if you speak about this episode with the female boxer, it was very interesting. Putin was not sloganeering against transgender ideology. He just said, I mean, if there are people who would like to compete, they should compete in their own category. And it's not okay if biological men are competing in the category of women. So they could go in another category and there they would have their competition. This would be fair. I mean, this is totally commonsensical point of view. I was also struck about his words about the Ukraine, the Middle East conflict, where he was talking also to a guy from Algeria who said, "Well, what do you make of the genocide and this terrible behavior of the Israelis?" I don't, as me personally, I don't think it's a genocide, but it's a terrible disaster, humanitarian disaster. Don't fight about words, but also there, Putin differentiated. He said, "Well, there was a terrible attack. They have the right to self-defense, but they have to take measured self-defense. And so, how they do it now, it's not good. We have to find a solution." And yeah, that was for me the very interesting. But I'm sorry, I get carried
Yeah,
away
well, no,
here
but
by my
I think that
impressions.
in Europe we are more vulnerable to this kind of demonization, not because we're worse people, but if you look in the European Union, for example, if you're going to have a consensus among this many countries, how do you get a consensus? Very different national interests. So there is a phenomenon, which is that we in the EU they tend to create well, essentially shame everything. They say this one good position, one bad one, and then you remove all the dilemmas, all the nuances, so all the complexities which one should resolve. So for and this is the way the shame descent into one position. So, for example, if you look at, migration, there's a lot of reasons why one would be worried about having too large demographic shifts too fast. But then, if you're critical of it, then they say, oh, well, you're a xenophobic person, or if you're against abortion, well, you hate women, or if you're critical of, let's say, gay marriage because you want to preserve the main institutions of society, well, then you hate the gays. And it's just the same with this LGBT stuff. If you're critical, well, perhaps we shouldn't chemically castrate children. Maybe it's not a great idea. Well, then you hate the LGBT people. So it's it you know I even if you want to take that position, you should still want to be able, if you want the success of this, for example, mass immigration, then you really need to address also the vulnerabilities, the weaknesses, so you can make it a successful policy. But we don't, because for consensus is often achieved through shaming. And I think the same goes with foreign policy. That is, when we see Russia, we have a conflict with it, which is very recent, good reasons why we have conflicts. This is most predictable conflicts, which have been building up for 30 years. And yet, if we want to discuss it, then it's always the same. Well, you don't want to legitimize the other side, so we build buy into this idea by explaining their position, you're legitimizing it or even justifying. So we effectively say, well, either you're for sending weapons, and or you hate Ukrainians and you support the killing of Ukrainians. It's such an absurd and also disgusting way of framing an issue, because if you really cared, for example, about Ukrainians, you would really delve into Russian concerns, because if you can meet the Russian security concerns, then you can influence their policy, and then you can make a better world for the Ukrainians. But we do the exact opposite, and and this is why I get so frustrated, because these people who push this demonization, this maximalist view, they always they look like they're walking with this assumed moral superiority. Meanwhile, they're burning down the whole country. It's just, it's shocking to me. But again, Europeans, because so many countries were trying to find some solidarity, I think we're more predisposed to this shaming and eliminating all dilemmas and presenting everything as good versus evil.
Just a quick follow-up question before we go into the actual substance of Putin's statements. What do you think? What stands behind this moralism? Is that the conscious attempt of stifling free speech, of pushing free speech away, of somehow establishing a unité de doctrine in a pensée unique, what's the English word? I mean, a forced consensus, you're not allowed to speak anymore. Is it conscious censorship that is really done on purpose by political authorities, certain political circles who want to have the power? Or is it more, probably a symptom of a strange time of, what can you say, economical welfare? I mean, we have a lot of very good years behind us, with bit cheap money and no economic crisis. So people start to get a bit frivolous in their head. Yeah, is it more this, or is it a conscious attempt, an attack even on free speech? What do you say as an academic who I guess is also under fire from time to time?
Yeah, from time to time, yeah. Well, I think I agree with what you said. Well, if it's been two good times, if you will, or especially if you had a unipolar moment, there's no more priorities. As Biden said, can you fight both the Chinese and the Russians? Yeah, we're the most powerful countries. Of course, we can do whatever we want. I mean, in this mentality, where's your priorities? If you're going to have a dangerous military adventurism, yeah, it's okay. You can absorb the cost because you're very powerful and you end up going into a lot of conflicts. And after a while, the problems begin to pile up. And this is the position we're in. But in terms of the moralism, I think it's also a product of again of the unipolarity of the aspiration for global primacy and hegemony. Because if you want to rule the world, which is pretty much the security strategy, then you also need to have the legitimacy for it. Because world order is not just about distribution of power; you also need the legitimacy for wielding hegemonic power. And then you really have to say that you represent universal values. And this is what we see whenever there's a competing security interest around the world. We always filter it through this very fake heuristic prism of being democracy versus authoritarianism. This is why we sell to the public, well, any part of the world we may never have even heard of and can't find it on the map. People still have strong opinions from day one, and like, why? Because we always frame it as being about liberal democracy versus authoritarianism, which is a good way of saying good versus evil. And this is a very problematic approach. Again, in the
It's a
50s and
very old
60s.
approach, you could say, European history. I mean, it's us against the barbarians.
Yeah, but this is how you divide the world in, because we don't have sovereign equality. That means every state has the same sovereignty. There's always been an effort to rank states in a hierarchy. So, but historically, at least through the 19th century, as you said, we said, well, you have the civilized states, which are the Europeans, and then you have the barbarians, the savages. So they don't qualify for sovereignty. This John Stuart Mill, all these people, they were liberals, but they still made this point. Yeah, but they're not civilized, so they can't have the same. They don't have the. They can't have these rights if they can't carry the responsibility. So this is the argument then. But now, of course, we can't talk about barbarians and civilized people, but we converted it into liberal democracies versus authoritarian states, because the authoritarians, they don't have the responsibility it requires to fully enjoy the rights of a sovereign state. So they don't treat their population properly. We have the right to interfere, to promote democracy, human rights, maybe remove a government, all of these things. So we recreated a system of sovereign inequality where some states should be more sovereign than others.
Which Putin obviously was having a speech against. What is the most important thing? I mean, you are an expert on many things, but you stand out as one of the lone voices, I would say, of modern realism in European strategic thought. One could say, somehow, in the field of a John Mearsheimer, of a Henry Kissinger, probably. A few years
Very flattering
ago.
comparison, so thank you.
No, I would say, I mean, you are a proponent of this liberalism, and of course you stand out with your book on the war in Ukraine, which is really a great book. We will show that to our readers. It's really an eye-opening experience, at least it was that for me. And so what is the most important thing Putin said on that night in these 4 hours? In your eyes.
Well, it depends. He covered a lot of areas. Climate change is important. They talk about artificial intelligence, how this was transforming, power. He spoke about BRICS as connectivity. But of course, the key theme was this Eurasian architecture, connecting the Eurasian powers. But for me, I guess they also talk about the New World Order was quite important, because it's often been referred to in this sense as a neo-revisionist, that is, he's rejecting the hegemony, the unipolar world order, the liberal hegemony, if you will. He said this is unacceptable. He also pointed out that the world is completely new. That means it's an entirely new powers coming up. For example, China being the leading economy. You have from Brazil to India, all these new powers which has to be represented. So in this sense, he's not a revisionist because he wants to preserve the United Nations as the main representative of international law, but it's also recognizing, again, the realist principle, which is that institutions should be a reflection of power if they are efficient. Again, the reason why the United Nations had lasted for so many years is because, well, for example, it gave veto powers to the dominant states. So dominant states had an interest in preserving the United Nations. This is also why, by the way, why I've always been critical of removing the veto power, because if you do so, it might not be interest anymore of states to actually preserve it. So you want the most powerful state to want to preserve it, and so I think this is the main area. And he pointed out that, while the past 20 years been very tough, he's expected the next 20 years to be much tougher, not just because of the shift international distribution of power and the shift in world order, but also again the technology and new technologies coming. So he foresaw that. Well, he rejected the West's insist to effectively rule the world to preserve this right, if you will. And
And he said, if I want to jump in here, if I can jump in here, he said that the model he proposes or he sees developing, he was not really advocate. I thought he was not advocating something. He was just describing how he sees how the world evolves. And he said, the future, as I see it, is cooperation between sovereign states. I mean, the term of the sovereign state, I think he took something that the new and old American president Donald Trump also uses. Donald Trump says America first, which doesn't mean America rules the world, but he explained it saying this means we Americans, I as a president, I am the guardian of the American interest. I have to take care of my people. And which means, of course, that you can say Norway first, Germany first, Switzerland first, and Russia first. And I see there a certain point of common language, sovereign states as the pillar of a world order. And sovereign state means you have to respect the diversity of different forms of government, of different paths through history. It means pluralism versus monotheism. In foreign affairs, and the question is, in that respect, is Putin really honest when he says that? Because the Indians, the Chinese, they are a bit distrustful. They have the suspicion that the Russians talk about mutual respect, about sovereign states, but basically the Russians, old imperialists, they just want to build an alliance against the West. Putin denied it, of course, but what do you say? Is this new nirvana, this land of love, peace, and happiness of sovereign states, is that somehow not designed by the Russians as a phalanx against the West? What is your take on that?
Well, for me, that's a million-dollar question, and indeed, that was my question to President Putin as well. Because we would sit there. It's not just Russians, of course. A vast majority are foreigners, so it's a lot of Indian, Pakistani leaders, Chinese. So this, so you talk to them, and over the days when I speak to them, there are this many who, they're all full in on institutions such as the BRICS to the extent it's anti-hegemonic. It's trying to diversify, currency, banks, all of this. So not just have one center of power. However, they're also afraid that BRICS it's not going to be a tool against the Americans. And this was therefore my main question for Putin, because if BRICS is an anti-hegemonic institution, then the whole world will jump on. However, if it becomes a bloc itself, an anti-Western bloc, like a new Warsaw Pact, then they don't want to be a part of this because they want to be anti-hegemonic but not anti-Western. And that's a
But
very
for you
important
as a,
difference.
sorry to interrupt you, but for you as a realist, I mean, one can say the realism is the no bullshit way of looking at world affairs. Is it realistic to assume that we will have this kind of Eurasian open architecture? Is it not so that in history, it's like in nature, you always have blocks, you have always powers competing with each other? Is Putin in that sense really honest? Or is he camouflaging a bit the strategic interest of his country in war, factually with, as he said, the collective West? So is he really honest when he says we are totally open? What do you think?
Well, I can understand why the suspicion would be there, because of course you want to be they're looking for friends and allies in this time of war, but it's also a continuity there, which is why I tend to believe that he's quite genuine. Because keep in mind that towards the end of the Cold War, it was the Russians who really pushed for having an inclusive Europe, that is to have a greater Europe, they called it, based on Gorbachev's idea. And it was from the United States where they warned that, if we give up on the bloc politics, that this would, fragment the power structures within. So this is what they really pushed for. Keep in mind, they wanted the OSCE first, and when they realized that we were going to push NATO instead, then they said, well, we can be a part of NATO, just so we overcome this bloc politics of the Cold War. And we said no to this in 2008. Remember, Medvedev called for a pan-European security architecture, one that goes over NATO, so we don't divide into blocs. And Putin, he suggested this from Lisbon to Vladivostok, EU-Russian Union, effectively. We rejected this as well. And and this we they tried to find a way to have a common Europe all the way until 2014, when they realized that the efforts in the West to convert Ukraine into a front line instead of a bridge, that now the game was effectively over. There would be no common Europe. And then they started to look towards the East to harmonize interests there, and that's kind of where we ended up now. And and this is why your question is great: are they building an Eastern bloc against the West? Because if this is the case, I don't think anyone would want to join in. And I think the support of the rest of the world is premised on the idea that this will be anti-hegemonic and not anti-Western. And as someone in Norway, I really hope that this is the case. And but this is also why I was wondering if this Eurasian format to harmonize interest, does it can it also accommodate Europe at some point? Because this is the main problem for us. We never overcome the bloc politics. And if you look at international relations scholars, they always point it out, not just now, but in the past, whenever you have a collective security system, the reason it breaks down and you usually end up in a world war is because states begin to prioritize their exclusive alliances above the commitment to the inclusive security architecture. And that's when everything unravels. So I think they have an interest, of course, in this. And people always ask me if I trust Russia. Do you trust what they're saying? I think I trust Russia to act in its own interest. And I think it is in Russia's interest to pursue this multipolar format. The bloc politics defeating the West, it's not simply in their interest. If anything, I think it's in their interest to begin to keep the door open to Europe, accommodate them, because without it, they would become excessively dependent on China. They want a balance of dependence where they have connectivity to all centers of power, so they're not too vulnerable to the pressure of any one center.
And the good news is basically, I mean, I was actually quite optimistic after his speech because I thought, in the end, in the realist world, you mentioned it, what is the most important factor? It's power. If you have overpowering power, then of course you can dictate. But the experience we have now is neither the Russians, neither the Americans, neither the Chinese have enough power to do what they want. So this reminds me a bit, totally different era, totally different situation, of course, no comparisons whatsoever. It's a bit like at the end of the 30-year war. I mean, what was the reason for tolerance, religious tolerance in Europe after this terrible war? It's not because the Protestants and the Catholics came to their senses and the Pope said, well, we have to embrace ourselves. It was just they saw nobody was strong enough to erase the other from the earth. So they were forced, because of the geometry of power, they were forced to cooperate. And I have just the impression, but it's more a gut feeling, that we are also in a situation where all the great powers are doomed to cooperate, and whatever actually their intentions are, just because nobody's probably as strong as he wishes to be, we will end up in a multipolar world because the hegemonical model is just outdated. It doesn't work because even the United States, they're so strong, but even they are saying America first, let's stop the stupid wars. Are we heading into a better world of more, even standing sovereign states? Do you share this optimistic view?
Yeah, well, often people argue that the realists are immoral or at most amoral, that they don't care about it. But I would disagree because I think morality for the realist means to maximize their own security, which is a form of morality. And in contrast, we often see that a common criticism from, Kenneth Waltz, all these, the traditional realists, they always warned for the past, what, 80 years that. When you try to introduce too much, what they would consider artificial morality, the problem is you end up either not pursuing your national interests, which is bad for your population, or you go on these crusading missions against other states, which ends up in misery for them and for you. So I do think that there is that the balance of power has a better format. I would push back on one thing though, this idea that realists would always maximize power. I think that the alternative is maximizing security, but which means that you expand your own power to the extent when you're balanced. But once you're balanced, trying to push harder then would undermine your security. So that's when you're balanced, now you make a deal. And for the Europeans, we kind of expanded gradually towards Russian border. We're not meeting any resistance until now. You would think that once we're meeting the full force of the Russian military, we would, okay, well, now we're balanced. Now we make a peace deal, and because further attempt to expand power will simply diminish our security. So I tend to see realism being more security maximizers, but of course power being the main instrument to stay safe in this world.
And the optimism, from the realism to the optimism. Do you share my optimism regarding at world affairs? I mean, we're actually still in very gloomy times, but I'm somehow I left this conference optimistically.
Yeah, well, it's an all or nothing situation because we're either gonna destroy the world now in a world war, or we're gonna, I think, come out at the other end maybe at a better place because we are in a transition. Now, I think multipolarity is more stable than unipolarity, but I also recognize in this transition it's a very dangerous and unstable time. But no, I agree, and I think the comparison with the 30-year war is quite reasonable because then you also saw the reason why we were fighting each other was because no one power was able to dominate. Even when if the Habsburgs were too powerful, you would even see the Catholic French aligning with the Protestant Swedes to balance the other Catholic Habsburgs simply because they wouldn't accept a dominant one. So you then saw again many centers of power with their distinctive traditions or values. And this laid the foundation for the modern world order. And I think you see something similar now. As you mentioned, China has a lot of interest in being the leading economy. It's good for its power and its security. However, if they want to be able to enjoy this powerful position, they also have to harmonize their interests with countries like Russia. Because if they do like the Europeans and Americans have step all over the toes of Russia, Russia can make life very uncomfortable for China. They can disconnect them from Central Asia, much of the rest of the world. So you see this incentive to harmonize. Also, if they don't take into consideration Russian interests, the Russians will lean more towards India, and you will have a natural balancing. So I think that this multipolarity is what is likely to also prevent China from pursuing its excesses, because a China which will begin to throw its force around and be very arrogant, you want Russia to have other alternatives, and they can lean more to Europe, towards the US, towards India. And this will be an incentive for the Chinese to continue to take into account Russian interests, not because they're, better civilization or, better people than us, but simply because this is in their strategic interest to do so. And ideally, you would see the same from Europe. I mean, before this war, we realized we don't want to push the Russians too hard, because if we push them too hard, we're going to push them too far towards China. You want them to have alternatives. And but again, we kind of lost our realist morality, in my opinion.
The realist sense. And just another quick quick thought here. Going back to the 30 Years' War, I just came up to this just in our conversation. I mean, the famous, you could say, political realist Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher of civil war and of crumbling authority of the state, he had this fascinating observation. He said at the end of the religious warfare, they came to the conclusion, to the principle, cuius regio, eius religio, which meant nobody should try to force the religion onto the territory of another state or of another monarchy. So every monarch, every president, you would say, or every country in today's language has the right to define its own religion. This was also the tolerance that emerged from this terrible war. And now I would take the parallel and say, cuius regio eius religio means today that every country has its right of its own form of government. And the Europeans and the Americans have to come to terms with that. And they cannot just say, well, we don't like the system of Russia. We don't like the system of India. We don't like the system of China. Or we don't like the direct democracy of Switzerland, which is so critical about the European Union. They have all to have the same system. Also, not cuius eius, cuius religio, eius regio. It's on that they want to have a uniformity. And this probably. This new sense of plurality of political traditions, political cultures, political systems, this could also come back in this piece of, piece of necessity, because nobody is strong enough to force a form of government onto the other. Another optimistic, probably silver lining at the horizon.
Yeah, but I think that's a good comparison to the 30-Year War, because if you can, for example, have a Holy Roman Empire which dominates as a hegemon, it also needs the values to legitimize this system of asserting sovereignty over others. So you want to represent universal values. So if you represent the Catholic Church, then you have us. We're able to assert essentially sovereignty over all the people within all of Europe. So when you see the distribution of power shifting towards multipolarity, you also need to have the source of legitimacy behind it, that each center should be allowed to rule themselves. And this is why the Chinese, the Russians, I would say even India would be very hostile towards this idea of the liberal exceptionalism, because under what we're saying is this liberal democratic values, they're universal. And it sounds lovely. I like liberal democratic values to a certain extent, but when you use this, when translated into power, what we're saying is, well, this is why we have full sovereignty and you have limited. This is why we can represent your people sometimes if we need to, and this is why it's unacceptable to everyone else. And that's why not just the Russians, but the Chinese are also countering this with the idea that, every civilization should have its own path to modernity. It's not necessarily a rejection of democracy, it's simply rejection of universalism. Because once you introduce universalism, you also forego the principle of sovereign equality. Because if these values are universal, why and your state isn't living up to them, why shouldn't we interfere? Indeed, it's our moral obligation to interfere to s support human rights and democracy within your country. And once the sovereignty is breached, it's hardly, if ever, will this only be altruism. Even though how good we would be, how much we would want the best interest of Chinese people, for example, we want more human rights. Once you have this right to interfere in their domestic affairs and, promote democracy there, then of course it's going to be corrupted by power interest, which is what you see these days as well. Whenever we talk about democracy or human rights, the rest of the world fear that we're already preparing our bombers. So it has a corrupting effect. So I think the best thing in the West we can do, if we really want liberal democracies, to build our own strength and be a model to be emulated, not to go around the world. It's also a common criticism of Woodrow Wilson, by the way, when he said he will make the world safe for democracy. No longer would there be this beacon to be emulated by the rest of the world, but they would go on a civilizing mission, effectively send their military abroad to push these values on other states. So but again, here's where the nuance comes in, because you should be able to support liberal democracy and still recognize that taking this militant approach to it and pushing for universalism is not the way to go.
And it's very important what you're saying. I mean, This is what we believe to be liberal democracy, with this aggressive aspect about it, is considered in other countries not as a liberal democracy, but as a liberal oligarchy, or even as a liberal imperialism, which is interfering in totally different traditions, destabilizing orders, endangering security, and then all the misunderstandings emerge. Let me come back. It's extremely
Can I
fascinating.
just
I'm
one
sorry.
little comment?
Sorry?
Can I have one little brief comment?
Oh, sure. Go
Just
ahead.
because
Sure.
before I went to Russia, I was in Minsk and Belarus,
Yeah.
and I also there met President Lukashenko. And when I come back, I heard,
Also one of the bad guys of
he's one of
of the
the
contemporary
bad
world.
guys, and that's why they say, well, why would you meet him? But what's the difference if he's how democratic? I mean, I probably wouldn't have voted for him if I was Belarusian, but. Who it doesn't matter. It's none of our business, to be honest. He's the leader of Belarus, a significant European country. You deal with the leader, and it's the Belarusians who will be able to choose their own leaders, either by democracy or other means. But it's this idea that we can't talk to people because they haven't bowed to the universal principles. It's beyond absurd, but it becomes so normal. Anyways, I apologize for interrupting.
No, it's a good point. Let's talk for the last topic, which we have to address, of course, is the war in Ukraine. And Putin made some substantial statements in that respect. We have heard that even President Trump, in the meantime, has called the Russian president, as he promised before entering the White House. He will try to sort that out. But let me start with a provocative thought to kick this topic off. Which is, I talked to a Russian historian on my way up to this mountain resort, which seemed rather Swiss-like here in the Alps of the Caucasian Mountains. And this professor said to me, "Well, of course, it was a huge mistake by President Putin to walk into the Ukraine. He miscalculated completely. He thought it's going to be a very quick fix. Putin is not the guy for long wars. He's not the warrior president. He's the pragmatist. He really miscalculated, bad intelligence, totally wrong picture. He underestimated the Ukraine. He underestimated the West completely. Probably it went to its head, to his head when he saw the Americans running off of Afghanistan and, in Europe, these politicians, these greenhorns. All around the place. Probably a thought, I'm the only adult in the room. I will do it now, macho style. I go in." He really truly miscalculated. And he added the second thing. He said, "Well, the second blunder was that first he put all his troops at the borders of Ukraine, and then he had a telephone call with Joe Biden, and they said, 'Let's meet in Geneva.' So he took all his troops back, and then they could attack again. And this was totally wrong timing because then the West was even better prepared." And I hear that also in Switzerland. I mean, there are many entrepreneurs that say, "Well, I always had some sympathies for Putin. He's a realist, but now he really weakened the position of Russia. And he's in a desperate situation. I mean, he has the whole West against him. He always wanted to have good relationship to the West, to Europe. Everything is somehow in ruins there. He's now forced into the arms of China." So my question to you is, as a realist, did Putin, with his decision to fix this militarily, did he make a huge, even probably catastrophic mistake? What's your opinion on that?
Again, a great question. I would like to believe that it was.
I mean, I don't want to push you as the PR officer, of course, of President Putin, but I really value your judgment, your realism. I would just be curious how you assess this.
Well, I think that the Russians, obviously, when they went into Ukraine, they had the different assumptions. Because if you look at the force they went in with, there's no despite what you hear in the media, there was the numbers weren't there to conquer the whole country. Also, the amount of force they used. If you saw in the beginning, they went very careful. We talk about all out invasion, but in reality, The Americans dropped more bombs on Iraq the first day than Russia did the first month in Ukraine. And one of the reasons was they didn't want to cause too much destruction because that would undermine the possibility of negotiations. And as we know, and you and I spoke about before, is the on the first day of the invasion, even Zelensky confirmed they were contacted by Russia, and they also pointed out the Russians were mainly interested in negotiating a settlement to get neutrality for Ukraine. So I think that this is.
Just to point it out, because this is something totally underreported in our media. This is something I heard in Russia several times, and you are now feeding it with facts. In Russia, they say Putin's original goal was not to conquer Ukraine, but he was to go in to force Zelensky to the negotiating table, and he actually succeeded because in April 22 they had the negotiations. They were very close to compromise, but then, of course, again, as underestimation of the West, it got derailed, and now they're back in full war mode again. Sorry, I just made this point
No,
because it's very important to stress this, what you just said.
your point is good because it always begs the question, what is the alternative? Because I think if Russia had an option of, do you want to invade Ukraine or just go back to keeping status quo? I think they would have gone with status quo. But their concern was that the realities were changing. And it's worth noting that in the 7 years we they didn't get Minsk, and as the German and French leader also acknowledged, they never intended to implement the Minsk agreement. They kept saying it was the only path to peaceful solution, but then they also recognized that they undermined and sabotaged the only path to peaceful solution. So this is after 7 years of this. The Russians attempted to get the security guarantees in 2021. NATO and the US again said, no, we're not going to give you anything. And this is when they decided, you know what, we're going to send in our military and impose a peace on the Ukrainians where they commit themselves to restoring neutrality. And this is, but you're right, the reason it's not promoted in the West or promoted, reported in the Western media, it's not because it's not true, but because it goes against the narrative, because the evidence is overwhelming. Even Zelensky himself, he gave an interview to The Economist in March of 2022 when he argued that, listen, we know that there's many countries in the West who would like to make this into a long war so they can exhaust the Russians, even if this means the destruction of Ukraine. But this is something we don't really want, obviously. The Russians on the first day again contacted Zelensky, confirmed by Ukraine. On the third day, they agreed to start negotiations based on neutrality. And all of this was not obvious. And what we also know is that the American British, they sabotaged these agreements because they were close to an agreement. Again, the Ukrainian ambassador who was part of this negotiation said Putin was essentially willing to do anything to get neutrality. They were willing to pull back their forces, everything. The head of Zelensky's own party confirmed it. The former advisor of Zelensky confirmed it. You had the mediators from Turkey and Israel, the former prime minister of Israel, Bennett, and they both of these sides confirmed, the Russians were willing to compromise on everything as long as they got Ukrainian neutrality. They would pull back their forces. However, both mediators pointing out this is not something that the Americans and British wanted. They had a good opportunity. Now they could finally bleed the Russians. They could fight Russia with the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. They could knock out an adversary. Why would you want peace at this point when you build up a powerful proxy? So all of this is missing from the media. And I always ask because people say, oh, it's controversial, Russian talking points, all these empty words which try to delegitimize you. But no one ever actually contests any of these facts because it's overwhelming evidence this is what happened. But nobody wants to talk about it because if you look in narratives, what does this mean? Oh, that means that now you're supporting the Russian narrative and not the NATO one. So now you're a traitor. But again,
Sure.
this is it's absurd because
But
this is
still, I mean,
objective reality and it's
sure. But
ignoring it is not in our
basically, I mean,
interest.
still, one observation remains. When Caesar crossed the Rubicon, for whatever reasons he had, probably good reasons, to fight a corrupt Senate who was commanding over a falling of a Roman Republic falling apart. I mean, Caesar probably would have said, I am totally legitimized to cross the Rubicon with my legions. And at the end, he was dead. I mean, he won. Of course, he could become some kind of emperor, Julius Caesar, but then he was killed by the Senate because he underestimated the Senate. You know, he was getting probably too full of himself. And the question I ask myself always, and I cannot give the answer. I agree with your points. Of course, I think it's very important. It's totally lacking in the picture, but still the question remains: when you crossed the Rubicon, as Putin did, was it not a huge miscalculation? Is he now in a situation that he actually never wanted to come about? One could argue, I mean, if you say that the Ukraine is such an important element in the strategy of the West of diminishing Russia, then you should be better prepared if you walk into that contested territory. If the Ukraine has that role that Putin gives it in his narrative, the collective West uses Ukraine as a sledgehammer to destroy Russia, to push it aside as an independent power, to have it as an underdog and its natural resources. I mean, if you see that as clearly as Putin obviously does, then I think the mistake even gets bigger because then he really criminally underestimated his opponents and also the determination of his opponents to use this country, now his language, to attack, to bring Russia into difficulty. So again, the question, is it from the realist point of view, a miscalculation, a huge blunder, a catastrophic error on the side of the Russian president?
Well, I think it's hard to argue that it wasn't because, as I mentioned, the goal was we put our military, we run into Ukraine, and then the Ukrainians will accept to implement the neutrality which they initially had agreed to. And you can go back to things war, but the fact that it didn't happen, I think this is good evidence that it was a miscalculation. And again, on the topic of Valdai, because I go to this meeting every year, and I noticed that. In 2022, when I went, the mood was very different. And again, the mood was, they walked into a trap. I remember I was at the Eastern Economic Forum that year as well as the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And Valdai, all these meetings, I got the same feeling that, they walked into a trap. They sent in the military to impose a peace, but then once the NATO went to Zelensky and said, "Listen, if you'll fight the Russians, we'll give you all the weapons you need. You'll be the next Churchill. The Russians will have to leave and get nothing, and you'll be able to join NATO at the end." This is, by the way, something the former advisor of Zelensky also argued, that the big war with Russia was the ticket into NATO. Anyways, so throughout 2022, I got the impression Russia that they realized they walked into a trap, and they weren't prepared for this. As you said, if you should at least be prepared when you take this gamble. And then because they were not prepared to fight such a huge war. But this is when in 2022 they began to mobilize all their troops. They begin to put up production, sourcing more weapons, and preparing for a big war. And then by the time I got back there in 2023 again for Valdai, this was right after the Ukrainians' counteroffensive had failed. They had been running into this Russian defensive lines and wasted a lot of manpower and equipment. And at this point, the Russians had mobilized, hundreds of thousands of soldiers. They had built all this powerful weaponry, got all the ammunition they needed, and they were. They had converted because no longer was the military only put pressure on Ukraine. Now it was a war of attrition because, as we keep saying in the West, Lindsey Graham says they're ready to fight to the last man. Well, then it's a war of attrition. They have to destroy the entire Ukrainian army, as horrific as that sounds. And by 2023, again, more than a year later, they had their army ready to actually do to fight this war of attrition. And this is when I noticed in October of 2023 that the Russians were then going back to Valdai. Also Putin, he was much more confident. They saw the war going this way, and to be honest, I saw the same thing in October 2023. I saw the war already being over effectively. It's going in Russia's advantage. Every day the attrition rates is more and more favorable to Russia. They have more and more ammunition, artillery compared to the Ukrainians. They have more weaponry, they have more manpower, and that discrepancy only continued to grow. So it was obvious that this was gonna come to an end. And of course, as NATO, we tend to lose this proxy war. We gradually escalate to try to balance it out. It's not working, and then by the summer of 24, I think we reach a very critical point where it's either NATO go all in what will likely be a nuclear war, or walk this whole thing back. And I think the election of Trump solves this problem, if you will, or this dilemma, as the US will now, well, more or less say to the Europeans, if you want to continue this war, it's on you. We were checking out effectively. And again, 2024, Valdai, huge confidence. I noticed myself in conversation with many people was discussing most of the topic, not whether or not Russia will win. I think this is quite obvious, but how to secure the peace, because winning the peace is quite a different thing. You don't want to have overkill or perpetuate the weakness of Ukraine, because if they can't get a diplomatic deal with the West, the goal, I think, is to merely seize all strategic territory so it won't end up in the hands of NATO, and then just make a dysfunctional rump state out of what remains. But this is not great. It's horrific for the Ukrainians, just from a humanitarian perspective, but also from a strategic. You don't want to perpetuate the weakness, because you're going to have a very unstable neighbor. So you want to have a peaceful settlement where the Ukrainians can feel safe, but also the Russians, which means we have to find a way for the Ukrainians to feel safe without having NATO, because if once NATO is in there, the Ukraine can be used as an instrument against the Russians. So it's not an easy solution to have, and most likely it's going to end up in a very horrible state for the Ukrainians, where they're not going to feel very secure. And this is, for me, this is a key concern, which should have a much higher priority. Because if the Ukrainians are not concerned, if they are not feeling safe, then you're going to have a very unstable future for not just the Russians, but also Europe, wider Europe.
Well, I understood you correctly. You're saying this total escalation into a great European war, even a nuclear war, this is at the moment highly unlikely, since the Russians seem to have to reach finally their goals. It turns out that the war, develops favorably for Putin. The Americans are checking out slowly. And the Europeans are just not, whether willing, no, do they have the power to really go into full-fledged confrontation? So this is your view. I see that correctly. You're not as alarmed or as concerned as probably, we were in last year or in other periods. Just a quick assessment there.
Well, I'm still worried. I think we are very close to a nuclear exchange. Whenever you see, the invasion of Russian territory, they could have taken Kursk, for example. This was with American intelligence and NATO weaponry. You see long-range missiles being shot into Russia, and of course, I do think that the United States pushing back against Britain not to do the last missiles, which would have to be operated by American and British. I think the Russians would have then struck directly back at NATO if this would have happened. So I'm very happy that we didn't take this. So I think we got very close. So I'm still worried, but I think I was more worried before, because now the Americans appear to be holding, back the leash of the British and telling them, this is not the way to go. And also, simply Trump talking about finding a peace with the Russians. I don't think they're going to be able to find a mutually acceptable settlement, but at least we're talking about peace. But my concern is, if Trump doesn't get the peace he wants, will he do this maximalist pressure? So it's still things can still go wrong, but I think
No.
there's more opportunities to end the war now.
Do you think, from your conversations you had at Valdai, what's the objective of Putin? I heard two perspectives. The one, they say, well, actually, he needs an exit strategy. He wants an exit strategy, which should look like a victory for him, because, I mean, he invested basically everything. I mean, he's the guy who brought stability to Russia. And now he's risking everything he worked for the last 24 years of his life. I mean, if he loses this war, everything is ruined. I mean, the Russians would never forgive him. You had a total meltdown of the center of power, the system of power Putin built up, it would crumble. You would have probably a backlash catapult Backlash into the horrible situation of the 90s. So he has to win. I mean, this is existential for him and probably even existential for the Russia that wants to be a sovereign power on this world. So does he need an exit strategy? Does he want an exit strategy? Or, as for example, Sergei Karaganov, the founder of Valdai, said, well, the war is so much in our favor, we will have to defeat the West for good in order to make them stop always trying to push us down, to push us back. We have to defeat them so they finally respect us and our interest of security. And if they have had this defeat, then we are even, then we can have good relationship with each other. What is it going to be? The exit strategy camouflaged as a victory, or is it the Karaganov way of defeating the West? What do you think?
Well, I respect Karaganov. He's a fascinating person. You know, he's been there from, you know, Brezhnev to Gorbachev and Yeltsin and Putin, advising all of them. So I can appreciate his perspective, but on this, I'm really hoping it's the first option there, because I think a political settlement would be much better. And also, I don't think Russia's objective should be to necessarily defeat the West. I don't think this is necessary. At least I hope not. This will be horrific. So no, but I think it's I think a political strategy would be the main way out, because well, then they can put an end to this. And well, furthermore, you know, Karaganov is quite eager in Russia developing this new Eurasia with all the countries in the East reorienting its economy and everything. I think this will be much easier to do if they're not in constant conflict with the West. And as my previous point was, you don't want an overkill either, because then you're gonna have a peace which the West aren't comfortable with either. And I make this point here in the West as well, this idea that you want to, peace isn't created by defeating your adversaries necessarily. You want to have a you know, you want to have a something looking like a mutually acceptable settlement, even though it's not very likely. So I think this is the main, this is a high priority to Putin. This is what my very strong impression, that if they can get a deal, like one of the benefits of getting the deal with the West is they're essentially saying, yes, we won't expand NATO anymore. This is over. And in terms of Ukraine, the you know, we let's agree these are the new territories. No more contested territory, and that's the end of it. And then we can start to build some trust over this. And I think that is an interest in the West as well, because I think many Europeans, we overplayed our hand. We thought we were gonna, the Russians would flee once NATO began to arm Ukraine. We thought we were gonna crush their economy before the end of the week. We thought that the rest of the world would, you know, follow our commands and isolate Russia. So nothing worked as we thought. So I think if we can get a peace, a mutually acceptable peace, many in Europe would like to restore something that resembles normal relations. Because keep in mind, perpetuating military conflict in Ukraine, it's going to be horrible for both Europe and Russia, because you know, you have other centers of power which are much more powerful, be it US and China. As long as we have this military conflict and dividing lines in Europe, the Europeans will be excessively dependent on the United States, and even Russia will be more dependent on China than they would otherwise want to be. They would like to diversify, also having this European vector. So I think it's this war is not in anyone's interest, at least of all the Ukrainians, of course. So I'm hoping that they would like a settlement, so we can try to overcome some of the disasters which, you know, we've been pushing through the last 3 years.
My impression is that not only for Putin, I mean, for him, it has a truly existential dimension, and probably also for Russia, but also in the West, especially in Europe, in some NATO circles. This is just a feeling that I have if I look at this hatred and enmity against Russia has become some kind of identity surrogate. They say, well, we have to stop Putin, otherwise the credibility of the free world is totally gone. There is no more reliable NATO around. The NATO has to win. We have to stop Putin. We have to defeat him. Otherwise, he will start attacking other countries, probably the Baltic states, with their huge Russian minorities. They will figure out something, a new situation like Donbas. They will start to arm the Russian minorities. They will stir up conflict, etc., etc. So we have to defeat Putin as well. Otherwise, it's our identity. It's our some kind of existential fantasy. The existence of NATO, the credibility is totally gone. Therefore, we have to escalate. I mean, Putin, he is not as strong as he thought he was. So let's put in NATO troops for good into the Ukraine. How likely is this outcome of events, NATO entering, really officially NATO troops, NATO troops in the Ukraine? How likely?
It's well less likely now, but it's still a possibility for it. But this is the problem when you have a conflict where both sides see an existential threat. This is very dangerous. The strategic environment when it's winner takes all, so you win everything or lose everything. This is when countries are willing to take huge risks and even risk nuclear war, which both sides are at this moment. But at the same time, we never define these things. Keep in mind that, we decide Russia also sees this as an existential threat. And I think this is why the Western countries, well, NATO, when we keep saying we're defeating Russia, but no one ever defined what victory of Russia means. The idea that you can defeat the world's largest nuclear power on the battlefield and somehow it's just going to withdraw and capitulate and submit itself to the West. It's never going to happen. You should pick up a history book and read about Russia. This has never happened before in history. It won't happen again. So I think we're walking into disaster. But again, I keep pushing this point here. But also when I was in Sochi, I was making the opposite argument for Russia as well. That you don't want to this idea to punish and weaken perpetually weaken Europe or. This is not a good way to go either, because the Europeans do see everything on the line here. They, if you look over the past 30 years, this whole European project, how it was built, everything is on the line now. The Americans will take their more and more limited resource and go to Asia. NATO will be discredited from this failure in Ukraine as well as Afghanistan. The Europeans are now wasting, weakening their economies. They're becoming less and less relevant, less and less prosperous. So what if they can just defeat the Russians, you can restore the greatness of Europe effectively. So they see this, the Polish president, I think, made this point that if the Russians, if we can't defeat the Russians, the golden era of the West will be over. And I think, there's actually something to this. I think at least the dominant role of NATO, of Europe will falter after we are defeated in Ukraine. And
So we still have the options, which is actually the more sane option of being not the dominant force, but the most inspiring force with our qualities. If we start to be a role model which is emulated and is not trying to force its virtues upon others. Well, so it seems, and now, I mean, it's so interesting. It could go on for hours. I'm sorry to take so much of your time. But so at the end of the day, we have to come to the conclusion that a lot of hope rests on the shoulders of the new American president, Donald Trump. Is he the Deus ex machina, somehow with magic? I mean, which he somehow, I mean, he has some kind of magic, one could say, because in 2021, hardly no one believed, I probably was one of the very few who believed that he could return to the White House in 2024. I wrote it actually in 2021. I wrote after the storm on the Capitol, Trump is the Terminator, like Schwarzenegger in the first movie in the last scene. No flesh. His leg were shot off. He's in this terrible machine with this pounding voices. And now he's on the way into the cauldron of melted iron. But with Trump, you never know. For him, it could also end with a sunrise in the White House. And, let's have a look. I mean, it turned out like this. This could be considered as divine invention, as Trump himself said, or even some kind of magic. Does he have the magic wand, probably to cut this Gordic knot of the Ukraine war? What do you think of what you've heard, what you see now, these intervention telephones, the proposal Putin said neutrality on the basis of the military situation of today, but the Russians are ready to accept an independent Ukraine, not a rump state, but an independent Ukraine, but a neutral Ukraine, no NATO. He's ready to speak to everybody. That was astonishing. He said, I'm ready to speak with the Europeans, I'm ready to speak with the Americans. So is Trump solving the problem?
He could again, but no, this was actually one of the main optimism from Putin's speech, the idea that he's keeping the door open to the West, that we can still find a way out of this, as opposed to fighting to the bitter end. I think this is we should see this as being positive. And I just like to add, yeah, I kind of agree on the view on Trump. I mean, love him or hate him, the guy is quite a fighter. The first time he took the presidency, keep in mind,
Amazing.
no one from the Democrats wanted him. No one from the Republican Party wanted him. The media hated him. I mean, he had everything going against him, and he still took the presidency. And then, of course, you had the whole Russia Gate thing, where they presented him as an agent of Russia in 2020. You had 2020. You had this, the media having going all the way, from censoring the Hunter Biden laptop. And in this election, you see they used the judiciary system as a weapon against him. They impeached him twice. They attempted to remove him from I think 16 state ballots. They really did everything to go after him, and still he won. Not just a victory, but he took, they called him a racist and a bigot and a Nazi. Yet he did better with the blacks and the Latinos than all other former Republicans. He even won the popular vote by about 5 million votes. I mean, who the hell anticipated this? So it was quite a victory. So again, love him or hate him, you can't really deny that this is quite an impressive comeback for someone who, very rightly so, most people believed he was finished completely after the events on January of 2020. But
And
sorry,
by
but
the
in
way,
terms
we
of
just go to the peace solution. But by the way, I mean, this is also, that has to be pointed out, this is a genuinely American story. I mean, this is also a story that speaks for the United States of America. Whatever you say about the deep state, whatever you say about the neocons, whatever you say about the, all these crusades they have throughout the world, this is a system where it is still possible that the total outsider who has been impeached twice without success, as you described so eloquently, who had everything against him, nobody was betting, $1 on him. Unfortunately, me neither, but I was writing it at least. I mean, he had everything against it. The whole establishment wanted to kill him. They wanted to, put him on one of his yachts, or, seal him into a tower of Mar-a-Lago. But he made the comeback, which is basically to the great credit of the United States of America, that this deep state is, for God's sake, not as powerful as some believers might think, or some observers might think, which is the United States. Still a fantastic country. If such a thing is possible, which it's totally great. And now we go back to the peace with Putin. I mean, this is the same experience that Putin has. He's some kind of Trump of the East. He's the guy, everybody goes against him. He's totally with the back on his wall, at least in the Western perspective. So probably they find the common ground as fighters, as people who have some kind of similar existential experiences, which could be a silver lining at the horizon as well regarding the peace in Ukraine. So how realistic is now a peace in Ukraine with these two, phenomena, these two political specimen, Trump and Putin?
Yeah, I forgot to mention also he survived two assassination attempts, and well, this is also with people like Mark Zuckerberg. They leaned very heavily, I think, towards Hillary Clinton, and they joined in on a lot of this censorship in favor of the Democrats. But even him, after Trump was shot in the ear, and when he stood up with his fist and bloody face, As Mark Zuckerberg gave this interview and said, this is one of the most badass American things I've ever seen. I'm also very proud to be an American.
Even
So I think,
Putin admitted that. He said it's so impressive how he behaved on the fire.
and that obviously went against his previous political, if not opinion, at least activities. But no, it's a very impressive story, this of what Trump achieved. And again, it all depends how he's able to carry out, because he has a powerful mandate now. If he wants to pursue this peace, I think he can. But it's interesting. I think it's also a good comparison is also, Putin, of course, because I know he's demonized very heavy here in the West. But keep in mind that after he took the presidency over from Yeltsin, this was all the way at the end of the 90s. Keep in mind what the situation was in Russia, because in Russia, in the beginning of the 90s, they wanted to, pursue democracy, capitalism, and just integrate into the West. They couldn't get fast enough to the West. They're willing to ignore China, Central Asia, all the countries in the East. They would just hold them back because they just wanted to be part of this greater Europe. And you saw their economy collapse. Society went through a horrible time. People dying like flies. It was very common to predict that Russia itself would go into the dustbin of history, much like the Soviet Union. And then finally came at the end of the 90s, 99, all this pain the Russians were going through. And then we essentially said, well, we're going to create a Europe without you now. The whole premise of all these liberal policies of Yeltsin was, have a common Europe now. We would expand NATO, so not Russia would not be a part of this new Europe. And then within 12 days later, I think we were bombing Yugoslavia. Essentially, their key ally saying, well, the United Nations international law, none of this really matters anymore. We are the one dictating now. So things look bad. It looked like Russia was finished. And indeed, in 97, you had Joe Biden himself giving the speech at the Atlantic Council, where he said that, haha, the Russians are complaining about NATO expansion, but they have no other partners than us. The Russians are trying to say that if we do this, they have to look to the east, to China. And he just said, oh, go ahead. See how that's going to go for you. There's no other partners than us. And he was mocking them. You can also try to get a deal with Iran, maybe. And, everyone's laughing and, this is kind of humorous. And, forward to the present time, they're building this huge Eurasia, not just Eurasia, but BRICS with the global majority, creating new international economic infrastructure. Most of the world looking for a different world order. And now, of course, we're having this huge standoff in Ukraine, which would either break Russia or, cement its role in this multipolar world. And but as you said here, they rolled the dice on everything on this one. It's either win everything or lose everything. So it's he's been quite an impressive character in this sense in Russian history.
And
Even
peace is at
Gorbachev.
hand now? You think peace is at hand with these two, whatever you think of them in their ways, outstanding individuals? I mean, you hate them or you think they're good, but they're in
Well,
some,
like
they're
them or
very
hate them
specific,
is, I
very
think,
special. Do
irrelevant.
you think peace at hand with these two special guys now in charge?
I really hope so, because look what we've it's happened the last 3 years. I mean, hundreds of thousands of young men, Ukrainians and Russians, dead. We're now at possible facing nuclear war. This is it's a disaster. So of course, I hope Trump will be successful in what he wants to do. But I've seen some deals, suggestions of what Trump might do in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not sure if these are leaks to feel out the, how it will be approached by the Russians or if it's serious. But but some of the ideas looks like a Korean solution. That is, Ukraine can stay out of NATO for, let's say, 20 years, and we'll just freeze the front lines, and we'll have an Europeans patrol. This is an absurd notion on every level. First of all, this neutrality of Ukraine is really non-negotiable for Russia. And also,
Putin would never accept this proposal
no.
that was lined out in the sketched out in the Wall Street Journal. This would be Minsk reloaded. You know, they would rearm Ukraine, and he says, "No, I didn't. I would never accept that." You agree?
No, but this is exactly what happened in Minsk,
Yeah,
2015. We all had an
Minsk
agreement what
reloaded.
was going to be done. We said, later on, it was admitted we weren't going to implement it. We're just buying time to build up a big Ukrainian army. So we're going to freeze the front lines. What are we going to do? We're going to use this time to build up a Ukrainian military, and then in anticipation of joining NATO. And as the Czech president says, you can take back the territories at a later date. This is not a good deal for Russia. The way they see it, they're heading for victory. And now we're going to say the peace deal is Ukraine can join NATO later in a few years. Meanwhile, we're going to build up their army back behind this frozen front lines, and they might take the territories later. I mean, this is a crazy proposal. We already did this for 7 years in Minsk, so they're not going to go for this. But again, the fact that Trump didn't put his name down on this, that it's leaked as a possible suggestion in the Wall Street Journal, would suggest that there's still some room to maneuver and they might be flexible. Indeed, I heard JD Vance say that, oh, if the Europeans try to put censorship on Twitter, we're going to just pull out of NATO effectively. Well, not in those strong words, but given that their lack of commitment to NATO, I think, is optimistic to the extent that they're willing, if they don't take it that serious, at least they might be willing to make a deal where we say no more NATO expansion. So, but I think any deal to make it acceptable to Russia would be neutrality has to become first, no more NATO expansion, and of course, recognize territorial losses. Now, at the moment, the Russians are actually claiming, Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson. A lot of territories they don't even have taken anymore. And Kherson and Zaporozhye go stretch on the western side of the Dnieper River as well. Perhaps we can negotiate redrawing these administrative borders so the Russians don't cross the Dnieper River. That would be good for the Ukrainians feeling safe. The Russians could also take some, to feel more safe if they're on the if they have one natural barrier. So, also, yeah, Ukraine wouldn't be landlocked. There's many things that can be done, and I try to point these things out because every day Europe, this war goes on, our negotiation power will weaken, and the Russians are becoming more and more convinced that a deal can't be made with the West, and they will impose what Mearsheimer calls a very ugly peace. And I keep making these points here in Europe, and all I hear is, well, why are you trying to take the Russian sides and legitimizing this and that? It's like talking to a wall. It's completely absurd. This is the reality. It's a very bad deal the Russians have on the table for the West now. It's going to get worse in the future. This, going back to, what the Russians deal they offered before it was sabotaged by the Americans in Istanbul, it's gone. They want the same one, but plus the territorial changes over the past 3 years. This is the reality, and we have to adjust, accept reality, unless we want to make the situation much, much worse.
So we see there is probably the will to make peace, but what is as what we see supposed to be on the table is quite far away. I mean, the time is proceeding. I have one very last question, which is we have to try to answer it as quickly as we can because it's a rather complicated issue. I mean, from the European realistic perspective, in the interest of Europe, of European countries, especially Germany, good relations with Russia are very important. Putin mentioned in his speech his great respect for Chancellor Kohl, who said to him in St. Petersburg, "The friendship, collaboration between Russia and Germany is existential for Germany's future." And Putin described this, blew him off, was deeply impressed him, and he said, "This was the leitmotif of my foreign policy, to have this close collaboration with Europe, especially with Germany." Now, on the other hand, there are the United States of America. And talking from a realist perspective, it is not in the interest of the United States of America that we have this symbiosis of Germany and Russia. With this could, of course, totally change the political landscape in Europe. It would give, how do you say, tailwind or headwind, tailwind, so supporting wind to conservative forces because Putin considers him to be a conservative. It would strengthen those voices in Europe who think, well, national sovereignty is good, which of course is weakening the European Union. They don't like this kind of talk. You would probably see a drift of the whole Western European landscape closer towards Russia. The British would feel isolated, and the United States, who have their fortress like embassy at the Brandenburg Gate, they would probably think that this attractive bride, still attractive bride, Germany, has been stolen by the Russians. So now this is my last question for you. What should Germany do? What should Europe do to have great relationship with Russia, as far as energy is concerned, but also with China, as far as the markets are concerned? You could say even the global South, the so-called global South, good relationship, without alienating the United States, which have a clear interest of destroying the close ties between Russia and Europe, which are so important for Europe and also Germany. What's the solution of this conundrum?
Well, it's yeah, it's a difficult question. So I think actually there's an international distribution of power which is very different from the past, which we seem to build our policies on. Keep in mind that ever since Napoleon had a Napoleonic system in the beginning of the 19th century, the whole concern for Britain was if the Europeans all band together, they will diminish the role of Britain. So this is why the British always had this strategy of, keep the European continental powers divided, and the British would rule from the sea. This is also what the Americans did from the 20th century. Dostoevsky has this famous quote where he said, the goal of the British in Eastern Europe is to make them hate the Russians as much as they do. And I think that's still true. You want to keep the main power divided. But this might have been a good policy in the 19th century and 20th century. But in the present time, if you push the Russians away from Germany, have another Crimean War like we did in mid-19th century and push Russia into Asia, which is again something we're doing now, they end up with China, like Germany on steroids. So I think this is not an ideal scenario for anyone. If anything, you would want the Russians to be able to diversify, to have this Indian vector, to have the European vector, not to become excessively reliant on China. So I think it's in the interest of the United States, because Trump keeps saying he wants to split the Chinese and the Russians. That's not going to happen. But you can enable the Russians to diversify, which is in their national interest. So you can trust that they would follow their interests. What can the Europeans do? I think the goal of the Europeans after the Cold War was there was this interest was harmonized with the United States. It was collective hegemony. You would have one, the West would dominate the world. West would be two pillars, the United States and the EU. So the EU was striving for equal status with the US. I think this has obviously failed, and but now that we're in a multipolar system, the Americans are telling the Europeans, well, you have to ally with us and, cut your ties with the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians. So instead of having one pillar of a unipolar moment, we see that the West is becoming subordinated, and it's not even going to, Europeans aren't even going to be a proper pole of power anymore in this new world. This is what Macron was talking about before the war as well. We are becoming vassals, or we are vassals. And this is even more so in a multipolar world. In a multipolar world, if you want to be a center of power, you need to diversify. This is why everyone is diversifying. Everyone's pursuing multi-vector policies. It's not because they want to join one bloc or the other. They just want to have the options and not subordinate themselves to a bloc. This is what the Europeans should do. But it's a very
But
difficult
how to
thing.
convince the Americans? How to say, hey guys, this is not against you. We're just having a honeymoon with Russia. We have great relationships, which makes us, of course, a bit more independent from the American influence. But don't be afraid. It turns out well for everybody. Will the Americans swallow these kind of, words and sounds from Europe? How to convince the Americans to let the Europeans from the leash?
Well, I think Europe has two options. It can either embrace the multipolar realities by diversifying, or it can ignore this and then succumb to irrelevance. So they can either have only one partner, submit themselves only to the US and be less relevant, or they can have higher relevance. So I think the main message to the Americans has to be, if you can be our favorite friend, if you will, but we also have to have our independent economic connectivity and independent foreign policy towards other parts of the world. Otherwise, your main partner or ally in the world is going to be very, very weak and insignificant. So, for example, Europe without Russia is not a great proposition. It's we there's a reason why the economies are now in decline, why a militarized, divided Europe is going to be really weak. I think it's it's a mistake to cut these two things. I think in a unipolar moment, the hegemon has an interest in severing ties between all the major powers so everyone becomes excessively dependent on them, because asymmetrical interdependence is converted into political power. But in a multipolar world, one has to explain to the Americans what they're doing. When you're asking Iran, sorry, when you're asking India to cut its ties with Iran, what happens then? Iran gets excessively dependent on China. If you ask the Europeans to cut their ties with Russia, what happens? Russia becomes excessively dependent on China. You want that multipolarity. You want that balance of power, because this is what will also constrain the Chinese in the future. So again, this is why, this is referred as Kissinger's worst nightmare, when you have Russia and China coming closer and
Coming
closer
together.
together,
So
especially when this partnership is defined as being in opposition to the West. This is a terrible position to be in. But the good news is the Russians don't even want this. And allow multipolarity to assert itself, because Iran, Russia, none of these countries want to be too dependent on China. This is why we, for example, have the international North-South Transportation Corridor, in which Russia, Iran, and India connects from a North-South axis, as opposed to being too dependent on China. So nobody wants excessive dependence on one pole of power. But you have to stop disrupting countries will naturally reach this equilibrium where they don't have this excessive dependence. But I think our interference in terms of trying to restore a unipolar order, it's pushing against these natural gravitational moves. So I think ask the Americans to act in their own interest, and I think it's not in their interest to pursue a lot of the policies which they're doing at this moment.
Fascinating. And listening to you, I see another silver lining. It comes to mind. I read last year, finally, I read this famous book, War and Peace by Tolstoy. And in his famous last book, he explains the forces of history, looking at Napoleon. And he says basically, politics is just a function of the accumulated will of all the people. So what the people want somehow finds expression in big politics. And there was a big wave, a big tide carrying Napoleon, a mediocrity, as he says, to power. And then, of course, at the end, the people realize that's not the way. And there is another mood emerging, and you have another model of cooperation. You had the Vienna Congress, the balance of power concept after the hegemonic or unipolar moment of Napoleon. And this probably is also a helpful observation for today. That, I mean, you described it greatly. I mean, in the interest of the people, what is in the interest of the people, of all the individuals, of all these little of us people, the little ants crawling around that we are, it's to have peace and prosperity. And everybody knows it's better to cooperate, it's better than to kill yourself. And, we are all closer than we ever were. I mean, we don't have a communism. We don't have, I mean, we have communism in China, but it's not, I mean, I was in Shanghai, whatever that is, that is not communism. I mean, that's probably more capitalistic as what we have here. So you have a strong will, a strong mandate, the tiger of the common will is pushing towards peace and cooperation, because the people know we are better off. We earn more money. If we build new walls, if we separate the world, everybody will end up poorer at the end. Even the United States probably have some short-term gains. Now, they can profit from the weakness of Europe, but at the end of the day, it's against human nature what's going on. So with Tolstoy and with Glenn Thiessen, we can say, let's not forget about hope. There is a an escape route here, which is probably closer than we think. You agree?
Yeah, I do agree. And I
Sorry
think
for my
also.
long thing. I wanted to thank you, Professor Deason. And excuse me, it was so inspiring. And our viewers will criticize me now for my long questions and long remarks. I really apologize, but it was totally inspiring to talk to you. We took quite some time here, but we will bring that without any cuts because it was for me a very eye-opening conversation. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.